Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm joined here in the studio today by our special guest, Pete Wallace, UK Commercial Director from Gum Gum.
Hi, Pete. Hello. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And all the better for the fact that Pete turned up for the Mad Tech Podcast this morning with Calippos in hand. I mean,
hang on though, where are our Calippos?
Yeah, that's the only drawback from this plan.
Yeah.
Is that we unfortunately had to get our colleagues to eat them while we do the podcast.
You say get, they pretty much grabbed them out of our hands.
There was a bit of volunteering going on. But I mean, Pete, seriously.
Well, you can't come to somebody's house without a gift, right?
Absolutely love it. Note to future podcast guests.
Yeah.
Follow in Pete's footsteps. And, of course, welcome to Lindsay Rowntree, our head of content. How are you there, Lindsay?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Yes. I love the fact that you call this a studio. In the studio today, make it sound so professional.
The sauna.
Not our, really hot meeting room.
Our meeting room that has no air conditioning on a 38-degree day in London. Just don't spoil the illusion.
I'm sorry. Yeah, we're a very professional outfit.
Okay, let's get started with a chat about this week's news stories. First news story up this morning that I wanted to run through with you guys on is Snapchat's results, quarterly results. So this has been covered in quite a lot of news outlets this week. Snapchat's Q2 results were significantly better than anticipated. So this is their... Are you okay, Hugo? You're just worried about that noise in the background there.
Yeah.
There's not much we can do about that, really, is
there? We just have to, we roll with the punches.
Shut up, you guys down there.
Always drilling noise outside.
Yeah.
Who's making the chainsaw noises? It's not us. Okay, where was I? Snapchat's Q2 results.
The cracking start.
Yeah, things are going well so far. Snapchat's Q2 results, surprising investors and the New York Stock Exchange because they added a record 13 million users to the platform in the quarter. Various takes on where the turnarounds come from, mostly pointing to the fact that the business is maturing somewhat. They had really difficult 12 months last year with with senior execs departing the company and quite a few issues with product delays. Now, we talked about Snapchat's results, I think it was late last year, where it really felt like what we were watching is kind of a classic story of a company going public, quite probably overvalued at the time, stock overvalued. And then, of course, we start to see a real decline in stocks. Yeah. And there's usually some kind of internal upset attached to that in terms of senior exec management within the company. And then investors start to get very nervous about what the future prospects look like. But these are good results from Snap's perspective. And they're attaching it also to the development of quite a number of new products that have just, or the uptake rather, of some of their new products, which are, you know, becoming increasingly popular. One is a face swap filter, which is a part of their sort of AR suite of products. Their content discover platform is doing really well. So people are using it to watch content, a variety of content on. And they're also opening out their software to third-party integrations with Snapchat tools and filters. So that's all sort of helping to grow their user base. Really interested to know what you guys think of this. Are we going to see some sustained growth in terms of user numbers here for Snap? Is it going to actually start to, you know, rival some of their competitors in the market? Or have we just seen platforms like Instagram get too much of a, I was going to say head start, but we know Snap sort of started first and then Insta got bought by Facebook and started to take over. Are we going to see them come a little bit closer together in terms of user numbers? What's your view? Let's start with you, Pete.
So, I mean, I think I look at this in two different ways. So I think they're doing some interesting things in terms of sort of bringing sticky content to the platform. So actually their partnerships with NBC and the like, which for me, Snap is, it's a platform where historically people have gone, they like a filter, they go on, they send sort of, you know, disposable content around, right? So actually what's the reason for people to continue going back? And I think that is something that they're continually working on at the moment with those developments. In terms of that massive spike in terms of 13 million new users, from what I've seen, this is very much sort of geared towards this filter around sort of creating a baby's face or whatever
baby
it might
face.
Be.
Yes, we all promptly had a go at that in the office yesterday. We're like, what's this baby swap face filter thing? Let me tell you, it makes us all look cute, but not quite like we looked when we were babies.
I'm sure. And look, you probably want to do it once. You're not going to necessarily go back to that baby filter. So actually, they're going to continually create new filters that people can come back to. You know, it was only last week before that FaceApp had a massive spike and actually they were were reporting just over 12 million new users over the course of a week, because all of a sudden there was this massive surge in people wanting to look like how they were looking 20 years or whatever it might be. So I think there's elements of a fad that are driving those increased users, and I'll be interested to see actually how many of those are sustained and actually continue to engage with the platform. I think that there will be a core base of users that continue to use it, again, using that sort of, I think it's called Snapchat Select, with regards to the sort of the content piece.
Yep. Lindsay, what's your take on this? Just before you start with that, I was just thinking, we ran an event last week with a bunch of direct-to-consumer brands, and I was chatting with a couple of them who were on our social panel, and they were talking about how Snapchat's really making a resurgence in terms of social marketing campaigns as well, and that there's a regional uptake. So it's becoming enormously popular in the Middle East and in some other more developing economies as where it's offering a sort of a messaging, a private messaging option that isn't available on other, sort of like-for-like platforms, presumably Instagram. Lindsay, what's your take on this?
I think that it's a really interesting point about the fact that those brands believe that Snapchat actually has functionality in those markets, and it teaches us to not always look at the core market, not always look at the US
as kind of
what, what's going on with companies, and it will be those emerging markets like that are helping to boost it and won't necessarily get talked about in shares announcements, but are very, very valuable and very important, and will like provide a growing trend for the company. I think also, like Snap IPO'd what, 2 years ago, if you look at, you have to have kind of long-term faith in the company. They've always been a company that's created great products. They've just gone about it in the wrong way. Like when they launched Stories, the creator of Instagram Stories actually thanked Snapchat for creating it so that he could go and steal it and add it to one of Facebook's biggest products. Mm-hmm. So they've always done a really good thing, and they've always done a great job, but then they go about kind of using it, monetizing it, and kind of retaining customers in the wrong way. So I think that there's still more for them to do, and I think that their average revenue per user for advertisers is lower than what an advertiser might get off Instagram or Facebook. But I think that if they've got a growing user base, they can only enhance that. And all they need to do is work better and closer with advertisers to try to get them to kind of deliver what your typical Snapchat user actually wants. And Pete, as you said, if they continue to keep, creating new filters and kind of adding new things that are going to keep bringing users to it, it's not just about bringing new users, it's about retaining them.
Sustaining
them.
And
that's something that Snapchat's had problems with. And I think it was only a year ago that Kylie Jenner tweeted
who uses Snapchat
anymore. So a year ago, everyone thought Snapchat is dead in the water. Like, that's just proof. She is the biggest influencer in the world. That is proof that Snapchat is going to go under. But they've shown themselves to actually be resilient and are coming out of it the other side. And I think when they IPO'd, people weren't sure. The valuation was too high. People were downgrading the stock immediately as soon as they IPO'd. People weren't sure what the future of the company would be. And they are proving that they can come out the other side. Just give us time and we'll do it.
Yeah. Stocks haven't recovered to their initial value.
No.
But of course, the argument could be that they're perhaps overvalued to start with.
Yeah, definitely.
And just on that sort of, I suppose, looking for new audiences, they've also got a mobile gaming platform, which is quite interesting because obviously, we talk about the sort of proliferation of mobile gaming and how that audience is extending. It's no longer a sort of a younger demographic. Actually, gaming is just, infiltrating everybody's sort of life. So that's a potential extended audience for them. And then there's also some talk of them apparently going into e-commerce, so looking at ways to enable purchases within a shopping and e-commerce platform environment.
Steal something from Instagram, basically. And the games thing's interesting because they're not creating a games platform and then trying to build new games off the bat. They're actually going to seasoned games developers that have games that are well known and beloved by gamers globally, and asking them to create a version of that game for Snap Games or a brand new game that's exclusive to Snap Games from those big developers. So they're going about that the right way as well, and that should lure gamers to their platform, one would hope.
They've got Tencent, which is a massive investor in them, right? Which is obviously very vested in the space. I mean, I think their core audience of 13 to 24s in terms of gaming is obviously, if they can get some traction there, will help massively. And again, it's sort of, how do you make Snap sticky? Like, there's always stats about how regularly people are going back to Facebook or Instagram, and actually, does Snap have that same appeal? And, content, gaming, etc., I think will add to that. And, we'll see over a period of time whether it's something that does create that stickiness that they need.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there was also mention of a couple of, you know, well-known celebrities. Actually, I shy away from saying celebrities. People like Serena Williams. She's hardly a celebrity. She's a world-class athlete. And there was someone else, I can't remember who, talking about their sort of, you know, going back to Snap as a platform. Mm-hmm. And you just wonder, as soon as these things become snowball effects quite quickly, right? And then, and also if people are going to Snap as a platform for content, there only needs to be some really engaging sort of world-class content, and that's where the eyeballs will shift, presumably.
Yeah. I mean, I guess my one thing about their content at the moment is it feels very US-centric in terms of who they've partnered with. So actually, if you look through that list, like I said earlier, it's people like NBC, etc. You know, they feel like they're very much trying to sort of get their core there. I know we talked about those international markets, but actually, what do they want to do away from the US? Are they going to start partnering with people around content in Europe, Southeast Asia, or whatever it might be, where actually there is a massive growth opportunity for them?
Absolutely. Good point. We watch with interest. Second news story I wanted to talk about was German publisher Axel Springer launched their news service update, in fact, probably a couple of years ago now, I'd say, at least 12 months, if not longer ago. And there was some news released this week that they've managed to reach profitability. Update is actually installed on all Samsung devices, and they've reportedly got 25 million monthly active users. And these figures are verified by third-party organisations within Germany. They don't necessarily correlate with some ComScore figures that are talking about their monthly users being somewhat smaller. But nevertheless, that says something about measurement. But nevertheless, they've got significant monthly active users, and they've also got more than 4,000 publishers on their platform from which they aggregate news. So they're talking about those publishers are also talking about Update accounting for between 1% and 10% of their mobile referral traffic. So they've got Update's a really interesting business, and there's several articles talking about their profitability. We were particularly looking at a DigiDay article, which is talking about how their business model unfolds as well. They employ a hell of a lot of journalists. Their pitch is this is sort of premium but quality journalistic-led content. It's an opportunity, or it's a business model that, you know, is sort of directly competes with Google News, and the principle being that they potentially return profits back to the publishers in a different way, under a different model. They've got a particularly sort of interesting ad-funded proposition as well. It's a mix of content partnerships and then programmatically sold campaigns, and they base the costs of those of that advertising based on a very, very targeted sort of element of their audience, and that comes right down to the way in which they serve their ads. They serve their content like placement cards, and then the ads appear sort of several cards into your experience on the Update app. So they talk about that being very tailored and very specific. So it's a really interesting business model. It's really interesting to see it gaining some traction and them being profitable. They've got a very clear mandate that they are wanting to build a serious contender in the news space to the walled gardens and other social media platforms that people might and frankly search platforms that people might be relying on for their news content and quota. So just interested to know what you think. This feels like it's kind of a good news story for options outside the walled gardens, both from the perspective of publishers looking for revenue, but also perhaps from an ad tech story as well. I'm really interested in your thoughts on what this says about the diversification of monetization models, because their model looks particularly interesting. Pete, what are your views?
I think this is a brilliant thing in terms of publishers. You know, they're very much there to promote quality publishing, quality journalism. I think publishers right now need as many discovery platforms as possible, because actually, you know, if you leave yourself to the likes of a Facebook, a Google, etc., like, you know, one change of their algorithm or change of the way that the newsfeed operates, then all of a sudden publishers fall by the wayside. So I think this is it's a great initiative. I think it's a brilliant company. In terms of the scale, I'd be interested to know the figures of the number of people that have downloaded it beyond the Samsung devices.
Yeah.
So actually living natively within Samsung devices, which I own one. I passively use Update. I didn't really know I was using it until actually this story came about. And actually, you know, I use it. I'm an active user, but not necessarily by choice. It's just there. So it sort of pops up. I use it and, you know, it's quite useful.
Yeah. That is interesting.
I'm
a Samsung user too. And I was like, what? Apptay's installed on my device? Where is it? I couldn't, like, that wasn't immediately obvious to me. So, and that's really interesting. What do they do beyond that kind of initial captive audience? I wonder if some of that's about also clearly verbalizing the proposition, because I can imagine some people actively choosing to use it, thinking, well, this maybe is going to be a way to get kind of curated a premium, high-quality journalistic content, but that's all about how you sort of, explain the proposition, I suppose. Lindsay, what's your point of view?
Yeah, I mean, I guess from that perspective, it's important for Axel Springer to make sure that they are working with... Thank you. Hugo's just pushing the mic towards me because I'm...
Thank God for Hugo, sound guy. Shout out to Hugo today, doing a very good job in a hot, sweaty studio. Don't listen to what Lindsay says.
In our professional studio. Yeah. Anyway, where was I? In making sure they're curating the right content, it's not just about a publisher's content being accessible and available on Upday. It's about Axel Springer making sure that it's relevant to the audiences.
Yeah.
And that's the important thing. And they've got a massive editorial staff at Axel Springer for Upday alone. I think it's like 50 people of only 100 that they employ.
That's right,
in the
50%
company.
Of their workforce.
Yeah. And I think that's the next challenge for them will be the scale of it. So it's the scale of the content, it's the scale of the users. Mm. So how can they make sure that they're constantly bringing new curated content from outside of those 4,000 publishers they work with, from outside of their three biggest markets, which are Germany, France and the UK, to grow and expanding that, and then obviously having to grow and expand their editorial workforce in the process. And then, Pete, as you said, obviously outside of just being natively installed on Samsung devices, who is actually downloading it? Who would think to download it? And probably many wouldn't think about it, because you wouldn't think of, you know, you said you were using it but didn't know you were using it as Update. It's not supposed to be like a known brand thing. It's just supposed to be a news app. It's not supposed to be, oh, I use Update to read my news. That was never kind of the purpose of it. Maybe for the next stage, they need to almost make it a brand within its own right so they can compete against Google News and Apple News.
Well, because if you think about it, we've been having this conversation in lots of different, sort of under lots of different subheadings, I suppose, over the last couple of weeks. But if you think about it, people do tend to consume news within trusted brands, you know, so they associate their sort of, their views perhaps on particular issues, news-related issues, relating to the publications or the sites that they would go to consume that news. There's no reason why that can't be branded, and it might be a better way to articulate the value of what they're providing. I kind of think that we might be getting to a world where, you know, publishers are building out a brand almost as much as they're building out a content business. And in fact, if you then flip that model and look at it from the other side, when we're speaking to digitally native brands, we know a lot of DTC brands are proactively building out a content piece alongside their brand. So, you know, my point of view is, why can't publishers do the same? And Update, different sort of proposition on the one hand, because they're aggregating news from other sources, but the point is that they're using journalistic staff to do the journalists to do that job, and they're really heavily investing in that.
Yeah, I think this idea of sort of, I think what you're kind of alluding to is, you know, you've got devices, you've got platforms, and then you've got content, right? And actually there's nuances within sort of OTT, like Netflix has lived natively within many Sony devices for quite a while, and actually, you know, they've gone to a point where they historically were a platform only, but actually now they're really known for their original content. Disney, on the other side of things, is trying to move into being more of a platform, where historically they've been a publisher, and there's becoming a lot of grey area between sort of where the platform and the sort of content provider actually lives. And I think that there's going to be a bit more of a battle between those two things going forward, and that's going to live within OTT, it's going to live within sort of written journalism and the like, and it'll be interesting to see who comes out on top.
Yeah. I wonder as well, because, you know, again, Update's proposition from an advertising point of view is, you know, we really know our audiences. We really know what they're consuming and where they're consuming it and how they're consuming it. Do they have a proposition that's that different to other publishers in terms of audience segmentation?
Probably not in Germany, but I guess from Axel Springer's point of view with Update, they are curating content from so many different publishers that they can then use their own data, their own first party data, but almost then consider the rest of it second party data, and then actually create a more curated, targeted, segmented audience structure than maybe other publishers can, or other platforms like sales houses can.
And I think
also from the advertiser perspective, the good thing about Update is that they, while they do a lot of the stuff they do at the moment is programmatic, they are trying to push the direct relationship, and from a market like Germany, that's obviously fundamentally important to them to make sure that the advertiser and the publisher have those strong relationships. And Axel Springer are trying to foster that and obviously push out the likes of Google along the way. The question would be if how effective that then is in markets like the UK and France, which are like the second and third biggest markets, because it's not quite the same system or structure.
Yeah, yeah. Might very much depend on the landscape, I suppose, of each individual market.
I mean, I think there's two things that I pick up from that. So sort of from a point of difference perspective, actually, you know, their big investment is in journalism, right? Mm. And actually, it's going to be more around original content. So arguably that changes the way that the platform sits in the future. And then sort of moving on from that, when you're talking about targeting an audience and understanding, I, without being too contentious, I'd be interested to see what their privacy policy looks like and actually what you're getting from a Samsung device that's actually shared onto the app itself.
Yes, good point. Interesting. Okay, moving on to our third news story of the week. Gaming app developers, this story is about gaming app developers sidestepping both Google and Apple in a bid to retain more revenue from their downloads. So in a news story earlier on this week, that name-checked both Tinder and Fortnite as two hugely popular apps that are making an effort to do this. So Tinder has developed a payment option for in-app purchases that means that users won't default to using Google Pay. So that means that then they don't have to pay Google Pay 30% of their fee, which is 30% in the first year. And in addition to this, we've also seen an article from the WSJ this week writing a really detailed piece on how Apple is giving preference to its own apps in search results within the App Store. And that's obviously they've gone into quite a bit of a detail in that article, and they've talked about and they've put those claims to Apple, who have sort of countered them and and said that's not the case, and there's many mechanisms that they use to try to balance up what comes out in search results when people are looking for apps to download. But in sort of combination, those two stories in combination are building a little bit of a picture of what both Google and Apple are doing in terms of managing and operating their App Store. I think we talked about Apple's app developer fees probably the beginning of this year, I think, talking about that 30% feeling really hefty and as though, you know, you've kind of got people sort of trapped in this marketplace. They have no choice but to list their app with you, and then you're charging them 30% commission for every download, which just feels like a really big piece of the pie. So is this a backlash against that? Are we looking at app developers who have got, you know, big audiences and are potentially getting a significant amount of revenue from in-app purchases, stand back and go, hang on a minute, I don't want to pay these commission fees anymore because they seem outrageous to me. And also, in addition to that, I'm going to try to find ways to create payment options for my users in a completely different environment. What do you think? Lindsay, let me go to you first, then Pete, I'll come to you.
I think I've always found this whole thing fascinating. And I think that the fact that Fortnite have done this, now Tinder are doing it, is really interesting and makes a lot of sense. If I'm them, I don't want to be paying 30% for what I deem as, you know, what am I actually paying for? Every single purchase, every single thing that my user does within the app, 30% of that then goes to Apple or Google. And as an app developer, that would be problematic for me. So I understand why they sidestep it. And it makes a lot of sense to want to do that. But then from a user perspective, if I have to then go and download it from somewhere else, like, you know, can I trust that this new place I'm downloading it from is fraud-free, is safe? There's an element of trust in downloading an app from the App Store on an iOS and Android. And also, if I have to then input my credit card information, where normally it would be done automatically through the app, as a user, is that the best user experience? And again, do I trust it as a process? If it's something like Fortnite and Tinder, maybe I do. But if other apps that are less well-known start doing this, it could start being a very, very dangerous environment. And I think also, if more of the bigger apps, because frankly, only the big apps can really afford to do this, go it alone, and they start taking a crap ton of revenue out of Apple and Google, what are they going to do? Probably start raising their prices for the rest of the smaller apps that can't afford not to use Apple and Google. Mm. And then that kind of just creates a...
upsets the market.
Yeah, it does. It does. So I'm very interested in kind of what this means. Will it upset Apple and Google to a sense of they will start rethinking how they monetize and how they charge people for using the App Store? Or will it just mean they just charge small app developers more?
Pete, what's your view?
I mean, look, I guess from my perspective, it sort of having read around this a little bit, so Tinder specifically, it's reported about $500 million worth of app revenue over the last year. So we're talking about $150 million worth of revenue, if I've done my maths correctly, to, I believe that was specifically to Android, unless I'm making that up. And look, that's a chunky amount of cash for them to lose. I think it's totally justified in terms of, you know, moving aside sort of from Google and Apple's sort of 30%. Like, in what business model is 30% acceptable?
That was my thinking, is what about just charging less fees? I mean, they stipulate it's 30% for subscription, for sort of continuous subscriptions, 30% in the first year and then 15% after that. So it's a sliding scale, but it's still really hefty, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, the interesting thing will be sort of who comes out on top. So actually, the premise is that you can still stay within the various app stores while sort of navigating around the sort of payment process. But actually, will Apple, will Google sort of get them on slap on the wrist and sort of to this point about sort of working sort of search rankings, actually people who do various things, will they ever be sort of put to the top of the app stores? And actually, how does that give them a sort of level of discoverability? Look, I get and I understand and I think it's totally justified what's being done. I just would be wary, certainly for the smaller apps, in doing things where actually you're going to be totally reliant on those platforms in order to sort of get that level of credibility and notoriety to actually get to that scale of Tinder and Fortnite.
And, you know, on that note, are we starting to verge into anti-competition territory here again? So
totally,
you know,
Google have already been pulled up for this in the US for promoting Google Shopping and all their Google scraping tools ahead of all their paid search ads, and ahead of, you know, if you search for a flight, you get the Google flight aggregator come up first. And if you own an airline company, you have no choice but to have your flights scraped in that tool. Like, you can't say no to it. So, and you either pay for the privilege and get more benefits, or you don't pay for it and you still get your flights included. So you can't avoid the Google aggregator, and they're shown first, and so they'll get all the revenue, and then you have to kind of like just languish at the bottom. So Google will get pulled up for this all the time in many of their different tools and apps. This is exactly the same thing. If they are promoting their own apps first of all, then they will get pulled up.
Yeah, I agree. I think the challenge that we have, or sort of, you know, the guys have, the governments have, in sort of cracking down on that, is that actually there's so much grey area in terms of the way that they operate, and sort of, you know, Apple will always talk about how the algorithm based on various different things operates, and actually it's sort of trusted and it's fair, but actually how are you ever going to dig really deep into that and understand actually what's under the hood of that?
And how are you going to know all of those details? Because the WSJ article, which is absolutely worth a read, goes into quite a bit of detail about the ways in which Apple, enable discoveries within the App Store, right? And Apple come back to counter some of the sort of, frankly, answer some of the questions that WSJ put forward to them. But there's a few areas where they're just completely they just don't comment at all. And one can only imagine it's because actually there's probably a bit of complex detail behind that that is algorithmic, and that's to do with, you know, quite a lot of computer coding. But it's also stuff that they quite literally don't want people to know, because we're talking about two incredibly powerful and wealthy companies here. I can't believe that it's acceptable for them to either continue to charge such high commission rates and service fees that some of their biggest customers, using air quotes here for want of a better way to describe them, decide to completely circumvent those charging mechanisms. Or if you do start to look at a lower fee structure or a sliding scale and start to try to even things up for perhaps smaller app developers, so a different percentage for smaller app developers, a larger percentage for larger ones, that then that doesn't create some kind of, you know, inequity in terms of how people discover your apps. It just doesn't feel right that they can control both ends of that spectrum. And it's really interesting that all of this comes in a week when the DOJ in the US have announced their investigation into anti-competition allegations relating to Google, Facebook, Apple and Amazon. Specifically, there was an announcement, I think it was yesterday, about one of the ministers in the DOJ talking about Amazon having a completely unfair competitive advantage over retailers. Now, I'm not sure. I know that's another complex question, and we talk about these things all the time on the podcast. Yeah. I know that there's much more to that. I'm not sure that I entirely agree with that, because they're also providing a marketplace, but it's all about that. It comes down to that same question, doesn't it? You can't charge people for stuff and control the marketplace and then shut it down when people don't want to pay you the fees that you're demanding. There's got to be some in between there.
Yeah, totally. I mean, look, Amazon's a great example of this. And actually, you know, they're notorious for clobbering various different retailers with regards to fees. And then where sort of, that's necessarily where they'll appear, but in terms of how many items they think they'll be pushing.
Yeah.
And then actually, if they see that something is selling well, they'll go out and create it themselves. Yeah. So actually, you know, they're one of the biggest manufacturers of batteries in the US, for the sake of argument. And like you said about sort of the travel aggregation in Google, you know, it's a massive space. They've gone out, they've created something themselves, and they've sort of now arguably own the space a little bit more so. So look, it's just a very, very difficult space to navigate. And I think it needs to get cracked down on sooner than later. And I would like to see people like the DOJ to move quicker on these things. But actually, you know, there's a tendency for this stuff to get wrapped up in so much red tape and sort of legalities that, you know, it takes years for anything to come to fruition.
Mm. Also, I think perhaps a lot of sort of government regulators, you know, no disrespect, but with the best will in the world, I'm not sure they understand the complexities of some of the tasks that lie ahead of them in this department.
They don't ask the right questions. They don't really know what they're going into with these conversations. And that's been evident with every single time a DOJ has got involved with anything Facebook have done. The questions they ask Facebook are frankly hilarious.
Impotent.
Yeah. And so it's not getting anywhere. They're asking stupid questions that obviously those questions need to be asked, because it's one thing us standing here saying that's a dumb question, but actually for the rest of the nation, that's not necessarily a dumb question. We understand it inherently because we live it, but the rest of the nation don't. So it's not a dumb question, but they need to get deeper. Mm. They need to get more experts that understand it inherently and can delve deeper into what Apple or Google or whoever is actually doing. And, you know, if the competition, if there's a kind of anti-competitive laws come in, is there a world where another kind of independent app-style store that's not Apple, that's not Google, that can exist on any device, any handset, they can come into play? Obviously, Samsung have their own one. I don't know if people even make... It requires people to make apps, developers to develop apps for that specific app store as well. But if they're charging 10% rather than 30%, maybe there is a call for something like that that's more independent and is actually kind of working to the benefits of the publishers, you know, a bit like Update does for content. Maybe there should be something similar for gaming developers as well.
Yeah.
It's a leap of faith at some point, right? Actually,
totally.
How do you move away from where the critical mass is to create something a little bit more unique and sort of that's a bit fairer to the end user and the developer?
Yeah. But it is going to be driven by, you know, in part by consumption habits, right? So, you know, it's really interesting that those two examples, Tinder and Fortnite, are kind of examples of consumer industries that have just exploded over the last sort of 5 to 10 years. You know, gaming's always been big, but it's just crushingly enormous these days, and that's going to continue to proliferate. Dating sites are just, you know, same thing, have proliferated, you know, over the last 5 to 10 years. These have become powerful apps, brands, companies, and you know, I'm really interested to hear about their level of in-app purchases. I mean, that's actually a much bigger figure than I thought it was, the figure that you quoted earlier on from Tinder.
But so, I think because they are Fortnite and because they are Tinder, they can do this, they can investigate this, and there'll be other big gaming developing companies that will be probably investigating something similar and are probably also looking into how they can escape the stranglehold of Apple and Google. And where that conversation gets them, or where that investigation gets them, is interesting. But there'll probably be more besides, and maybe more that don't, maybe more that kind of, I don't know how it worked for them, but that do stay. And if they do stay, it needs to be, it can't just be, okay, well, we're staying and Apple and Google have won. There has to be something else that comes out of it. There has to be.
And I think at least covers, you know, the fact that at least in the short term, payment sort of processing and payment solutions, it does feel like that's really sewn up within the app market at the moment between, you know, Google Pay, Apple Pay. So you can see, because that's specifically what Tinder are focusing on, is the app is still downloadable within both of those stores, but when it comes to purchasing, they're directly funneling them away.
And Netflix did the same thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd be interested to see whether Tinder reduced the price of in-app purchases as a result of moving
That's
away.
That's a really good point. I bet they don't.
Very good point. We all remember the good old days of credit card, enhanced credit card fees. I mean, I know a lot of fees still exist, but, you know, remember you used to get particularly bumper fees for Amex or diners cards or something like that, because I suppose they were sort of less transacted on, but you wondered where those fees go to. Payment solutions, payment merchanting, it's a really interesting area,
yeah,
I reckon.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, well, moving on to the second part of the podcast. Pete, tell us a little bit about Gum Gum for all of our listeners, and more specifically, talk a little bit about some of the things that you've been working on recently or some of the things that are really big in your minds at Gum Gum at the moment.
Yeah, sure thing. So, look, I guess the elevator pitch on Gum Gum. So we would term ourselves as an artificial intelligence company with a deep expertise in computer vision and natural language processing. Apologies.
Impressive.
So, look, what we're basically trying to do is get our technology to analyze, understand content, text and image-based in the same way that a human would. And then what we're able to then do is, from a contextual standpoint, when we're talking about our advertising business, is analyze and understand a page to a greater degree of detail than anybody else will do so, and then apply that from a targeting perspective and a brand safety perspective. So there's this core technology that we then combine with creative functionality, so looking predominantly at sort of brand engagement, and then also working with premium publishers, so making sure that the content that people are working within actually aligns with sort of, you know, those publishers that they want to work with.
And you're working with publishers and agencies?
Yeah, totally. So we sit on sort of both sides. So from a creative standpoint, what we're very much trying to do is sort of monetize space where typically people aren't monetizing it that well. So, you know, in image is sort of one of our placements, so actually a spot where we know people are paying a great deal of attention to, but actually historically publishers haven't been monetizing that space previously, and then sort of other spaces around the page. So very much trying to live in and around the content, again, sort of places where we believe that people are paying attention to, whilst also trying to be sympathetic to user experience.
Great. And so because you get to see sort of both sides, well, you know, because you work across both sides of the industry and you get to see sort of both sides of the coin, tell me a little bit, we were just talking in the lead up to this, tell me a little bit about your perspective on things like brand safety.
Yep.
And also measurement, just because I know these are both things we touched on sort of in the lead up to this podcast, but these are things that, you know, still feel like really quite fundamental challenges in the industry, in the advertising and marketing technology industry. And we're still talking about them, you know, sort of years and years down the track. I know that plenty of people would say things have moved on, but, you know, I'd be really interested to hear your perspective on those challenges from the point of view of the work that you're doing directly with publishers and, you know, brands, either via agencies or if you work with any brands direct.
Yeah, sure.
And where you feel that sort of position is at the moment.
So, I mean, look, there's obviously been massive strides in terms of brand safety across the industry. I think it was fundamental to actually getting a little bit more credibility for a number of people. And look, from my standpoint, it still sits as a massive issue. Sort of fraud rates across the industry are still taking huge amounts of sort of ad dollars. Obviously, ad fraud is still a massive issue, still lots of dollars being lost. Brand safety, you know, this is something that continually rears its head. And look, I think that there's been massive strides, as I say. So sort of blacklisting, I think, has sort of been one of the things that a lot of people have taken on board. Whitelisting has obviously been sort of something that is sort of growing and growing and growing. I guess sort of a lot of what my take on that sort of space is that actually you only know what you know. So from a whitelisting perspective, actually, why would you really whittle down your sort of audience or your domains to a specific sort of 50, 60 domains when actually that's going to really sort of mitigate what you're able to do across sort of reach across the web? So from our perspective, actually, you know, blacklisting, I can totally buy into. Actually, let's get rid of YouPorn and various things that I've been told about in the past.
not familiar with personally.
Not familiar with at all. But actually, you know, then let's look at the broader web where actually there's still quality journalism and actually there's good content, and let's understand it on a page by page basis. So as I say, from our perspective, it's very much about sort of being able to scan as a human would. So, you know, just because there's profanity in text on a page actually doesn't necessarily mean for every brand that it's not brand safe. You know, similarly, if there's not sort of a bad word in a piece of text, actually, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's brand safe. Mm. So actually, you know, we need to do more than working on sort of flat keyword structures to understand what's going on. And then, look, we work with a variety of publishers who house a lot of image galleries, right? And historically, you know, this is a space where actually brand safety mechanisms aren't able to analyze and understand what's within that imagery. So for us, it's about taking it that level beyond and sort of, you know, we talked a lot about Snap for the sake of argument, and there's a lot of image-based sort of platforms. People like the Mail Online, they use an awful lot of galleries. Actually, you know, you want to look at how brand safety operates across that space. Overexposure of skin, is there an accident in there? Is there, you know, a competitive brand? There's various different things that we feel like we need to look out for that can sort of take brand safety to a next level and really help sort of navigate people through what is a bit of a minefield in reality.
And so you talked about blacklisting. There's also kind of, there are still facets of the industry out there that are so terrified of the brand safety, and particularly the demands from advertisers to make sure that everything they buy is brand safe, that they go down the whitelisting route.
Yeah.
And it feels like that's quite limiting, and they go down the whitelisting route because they don't know, you know, they can't be sure that everything that's on a page is safe or as it should be. And you mentioned kind of, you know, there's companies that just look for a word or look for a specific image. How do you make sure that you can kind of make people feel safe and not go down the whitelisting route and feel there's actually the context of, on a page, and particularly with the imagery on it, can be properly tracked and understood?
Yeah, I mean, look, so everything that we as a business do is very much pre-bid. So before it hits your DSP, we're analysing the entirety of our bid stream to make sure that sort of every piece of content that is passed through to an advertiser is completely sort of covered off. We also work with a partner called YTOPS to make sure that we're sort of fraud free. And look, I think that that's fundamental. And I think having as much transparency across this as possible as well, right? So actually, how much information and data can I pass to that end advertiser in terms of page level information, in terms of sort of the actual context that actually people sort of really sort of geared towards based on sort of, you know, their KPIs and things. So, you know, I know that we ban the word transparency around as an industry an awful lot, but I think that's still fundamental to everything that we do. And actually, I don't think there's still enough transparency in the industry as there should be.
And do you have sort of, you know, have you worked with clients which have just been, like Lindsay was saying, fixed on the notion of developing a whitelist because they're so concerned about fraud, and you've managed to divert them a little bit from that and shown them the sort of, you know, potential results?
Yeah, totally. I mean, look, there's been instances, and again, it's sort of, I think for us, it's about getting under the hood of the technology and being able to showcase the sort of tangible benefit of what it's doing. So actually, you know, what we can showcase to people is, this is what we blocked based on text-based references. This is what we blocked based on image-based references. And actually, it can become a lot more tangible to the end advertiser to actually understand what we're blocking and why we're blocking it. And again, just being able to sort of give people the opportunity to kick the tires on what we do, I think, is important.
Have a look around.
Yeah, totally. Mm. I mean, you know, it can't just be the algorithm stopped it from reaching. It needs to be, actually, we blocked it because of X, Y, Z. And if you pass that sort of level of information to people, then I think, you know, they can understand, they can interpret, and then they can sort of hopefully move on with sort of agreeing with our ideology around that.
Becomes a more compelling proposition once seen it in action. Mm. We were talking a little bit about measurement as well.
Yep.
So say a little bit about your views on measurement and what brands and advertisers are sort of looking for in terms of measurement metrics, how you've seen that change.
Look, I've been in the industry for, what, about 12, 13, 14 years maybe now. It's been a while. We've continually talked about measurement in various different ways through that entire time. And it's a portion of the industry that we want to get to this point, this sort of, you know, this nirvana where we can manage and understand everything in one central platform. You know, you understand uplift, you understand the end result on sales. We're nowhere near there. And I still think that it's a space which fundamentally is broken for the industry. You know, there was obviously the IAB Clickheads video a little while ago, which I think was quite interesting, sort of moving away from CTR. You know, to be quite honest, I've seen a little bit of a migration away from people going, right, I want CTR. We're still sort of fixated on sort of things like viewability stats, engagement stats. And do you know what? These are stats that the industry can game. And that, I think, is what fundamentally frustrates me. And what we're also seeing now is that a lot of people are going, right, I want reach and frequency. And, you know, you dig into that a little bit and you're like, right, what does that actually mean? And they're like, well, I want reach and frequency.
but what do you want me to do? Like, I can buy cheap and I can hit everybody on the web, or, you know, you're going to buy across Facebook and you can reach everybody. But actually, you know, how does that impact the business outcome? How are people engaging with that? How are people sort of interacting and sort of grabbing their attention? And I don't think that we've necessarily reached a point where we take time to understand that and connect all of the dots. We're still, you know, we're making a sort of conscious effort to move away from those base level metrics into something else, but I don't think anybody really knows what that something else should be. And that's something I'd really like to see us work upon. And look, we're sort of reviewing sort of things like eye tracking studies and the like, and sort of, you know, we'd all love to run a brand study on things, but you know, there's probably things that we need to work on that area as well, sort of where we're talking about sort of small levels of data to try and understand brand recall or sort of sales uplift. It becomes very tricky.
Yeah. And so is that a conversation, that sort of measurement frustration, which is very familiar, by the way, Pete? Many people saying, I've worked in this industry for, you know, X number of years, and it feels like we keep having this conversation. Is it a conversation that you're having with agencies or brands direct? And that little shift that you talked about, and you sort of did mention it being small, Are you feeling like there's some momentum behind that at all?
Honestly, at the moment, I think it's sort of the faint murmurings that are starting to sort of tick on through, which is interesting and it's good to hear. I think that the conversations are primarily happening with agencies at the moment. And look, having come from an agency background, I've sort of, you know, I've had that frustration for quite a while in terms of wanting to move metrics along a little bit, but not necessarily having a solution for it. And I think that agencies, as sort of, you know, educated people and specialists within digital, should be driving that conversation upwards into the end advertisers. And look, I think it will take time to shift. Like I said, sort of having worked in the industry for X number of years, you know, it's something that we tried to shift and tried to shift and tried to shift. But, you know, I think that people then get fixated on actually what's the CPA on that. And, you know, again, I can drive you lots of sales, I'll just retarget the hell out of everybody.
It feels like there's things that we talk about. We have a level of understanding within the industry, and it's, you know, we know what we know, and we think that is kind of the solution and the answer. But actually, when it comes to putting things into practice, it feels like there's still a lot more education required on the publisher side and the buy side as well. And it feels like the right questions aren't always being asked. And sometimes within ad tech, you can be in a bit of an echo chamber and talk about, yes, we are doing this, and this is how you should measure, and this is what you should be doing. But then when it comes to actually applying that in the real world, it feels like it isn't happening. Do you find that there needs to be more asking the right questions and maybe educating? You talked about publishers and making sure they understand which parts of their page are the most viewed and the most kind of, and the most, you know, engaged with. And then making sure that agencies understand the measurement possibilities, but then working with their own clients to make sure they understand the measurement possibilities. Is it just that there needs to be more openness? We talked about transparency again, more openness and more conversations happening with all parties involved to know what is possible and what is not possible and what is not just part of the echo chamber.
Yeah, I mean, look, totally. I absolutely agree with that, and I don't have a great deal more to add of
that. Okay, well, that has pushed us to a point where we've run out of time, which is actually probably delight to the ears of our podcast guests, because
I'm extremely sweaty.
It is really hot in here.
It's horrible. It's really horrible.
Please feel sorry for us, listeners. I know. See, the thing is, you know, by the time everyone listens to this, it'll probably be rainy and cold, as usual. It's just the one day of sunshine, hot sunshine. Anyway, thank you very much for coming in to chat with us this morning, Pete.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Not at all. And Lindsay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.